kingdoms of Ulburn and Dunmore blurred together. To Hadrian, the forest appeared as an ocean of unbroken green, miles and miles of rugged wilderness, on the other side of which lay the tiny village called Dahlgren. Because the wind on the hilltop was cool and strong enough to drive off the flies, it made a perfect place to break for a midday meal. They ate salted pork, hard, dark bread, onions and pickles. It was the kind of meal Hadrian would loathe to eat in a town, but it seemed somehow wonderful on the road, where his appetite was greater and options were fewer. He watched Thrace sitting on the grass, nibbling on a pickle, being careful not to stain her new dress. She gazed off with a faraway look, inhaling the air in deep, appreciative breaths. "What are you thinking?" he asked. She smiled at him a bit self-consciously, and he thought he noticed a sadness about her. "I was just thinking how wonderful it is here, how nice it would be to live on one of those farms we passed. We wouldn't need anything grand, not even a house. My father can build a house all by himself, and can turn any soil. There's nothing he can't do once he sets his mind to it, and once he sets his mind, there's no changing it. Sounds like a great guy." "Oh, he is. He's very strong, very determined." "I'm surprised he would allow you to set off alone across the country like you did." Frey smiled. "You didn't walk all the way, did you?" "Oh, no. I got a ride with a peddler and his wife, who stopped in Dahlgren. They refused to spend a second night and let me ride in the back of their wagon." "Have you done much travelling before?" "No. I was born in Glamrendor, the capital of Dunmore. My family worked a tenant farm for his lordship there. We moved to Dahlgren when I was about 9, so I've never been out of Dunmore until now. I can't even say I remember all that much of Glamrendor. I do recall it was dirty, though. All the buildings were made of wood, and the roads were very muddy. At least, that's how I remember it."
"Still that way," Royce mentioned.
"Can't believe you had the courage to just go off like that," Hadrian said, shaking his head. "It must have been a shock leaving Dahlgren, and a few days later finding yourself in the largest city in the world."
"Oh, it was,"
she replied, using her pinky finger to draw away a number of hairs that had blown into her mouth. "I felt foolish when I realized just how hard it was going to be to find you. I expected it would be like back home, where I would be able to walk up to anyone and they would know who you were. There are a lot more people in Colnora than I expected. To be honest, there's a lot more of everything. I looked and looked and I thought I would never find you."
"I expect your father will be worried."
"No, he won't," she said. "But if..."
"What are these things?"
she asked, pointing to the standing stones with her pickle.
"These blue stones, they're so odd."
"No one knows," Royce replied.
"Were they made by elves?" she asked.
Royce cocked his head and stared at her.
"How did you know that?"
"They look a bit like the tower near my village, the one I need you to open. The same kind of stone, at least I think so. The tower looks bluish too, but it might be because of the distance. Ever notice how things get blue in the distance? I suppose if we could actually get near it, we might find it was just a common grey, you know?"
"Why can't you get near it?" Hadrian asked.
"Because it's in the middle of the river."
"Can't you swim?"
"You'd have to be a really strong swimmer. The tower is built on a rock that hangs over a waterfall. Beautiful falls. Really high, you know. Lots of water going over. On sunny days, you can see rainbows in the mist. Of course, it's very dangerous. At least 5 people have died. Only 2 are for sure. The other 3 are just guesses because..."
She paused when she saw the looks on their faces.
"Is something wrong?"
"You might have said something earlier," Royce replied.
"About the waterfall?
Oh, I thought you knew. I mean, you acted like you knew the tower when I mentioned it before. I'm sorry. They ate in silence for a few moments. Thrace finished her lunch and walked around looking at the stones, her dress billowing behind her.
"I don't understand," she finally said, raising her voice over the wind. "If the Nidwalden is the border, why are there elven stones here?"
"This used to be elven land," Royce explained. "All of it. Before there was a Kolnora, or a Warwick, it was part of the Erevan Empire. Most don't like to acknowledge that. They prefer to think that men always ruled here. It bothers them. Funny thing is, many of the names we use are elvish. Ervanon, Renyid, Glamrendor, Galewar, and Nidwalden are all elven. The very name of this country, Avron, means green fields.
Try and tell that to someone in a bar sometime and see how fast you get cracked in the head," Hadrian mentioned, drawing looks from both of them.
While they finished eating, Thrace stood among the great stones staring west, her hair and dress whipping about. Her sight rose to the horizon, out beyond Kolnora, beyond the blue hills, to the thin line of the sea. She looked so small and delicate, he half expected the wind to carry her away like some golden leaf. And then he noticed the look in her eyes. She was little more than a child, and yet her eyes were older. The glow of innocence and the sparkle of wonder were absent. There was a weight to her face, a determination in her gaze. Whatever childhood she had known had long since abandoned her. They finished their food, packed up, and set off again. Descending the far side of the heights, they continued to follow the road for the remainder of the day. But as the sunset neared, the road narrowed to little more than a simple trail. Farmhouses still appeared from time to time, but they were less frequent. The forest grew thicker, and the road darker. As sunlight faded, Thrace grew very quiet. There was nothing to see or point out any more, but Hadrian guessed it was more than that. Mouse skipped a stone into a wind-blown pile of the past year's leaves, and Thrace jumped, grabbing his waist. She dug her nails in deep enough to make him wince.
"Shouldn't we find shelter?" she asked.
"Not much chance of that out here," Hadrian told her. "From this point on, we'll be leaving civilization behind. Besides, it's a lovely evening. The ground is dry, and it looks like it'll be warm."
"We're sleeping outside?"
Hadrian turned around to see her face. Her mouth was open slightly, her forehead creased, her eyes wide and looking up at the sky.
"We're still a long way from Dahlgren," he assured her.
She nodded, but held on to him tighter. They stopped at a clearing near a little creek that flowed over a series of rocks, making a friendly rushing sound. Hadrian helped Thrace down and pulled the saddles and gear off the horses.
"Where's Royce?"
Thrace asked in a whispered panic. She stood with her arms folded across her chest, looking around anxiously.
"It's okay," Hadrian told her, as he pulled the bridle off Millie's head.
"He always does a bit of scouting whenever we stop for the night. He'll circle the area, making sure we're alone. Royce hates surprises."
Thrace nodded, but remained huddled, as if standing on a stone amidst a raging river.
"We'll be sleeping right over there. You might want to clear it some. A single stone can ruin a night's sleep." "I ought to know. It seems whenever I sleep outside, I always end up with a stone under the small of my back."
She walked into the clearing and gingerly bent over, tossing aside branches and rocks, nervously glancing skyward and jumping at the slightest sound. By the time Hadrian had the horses settled, Royce had returned. He carried an armload of small branches and a few shattered logs, which he used to build a fire. Thrace stared at him, horrified.
"It's so bright," she whispered.
Hadrian squeezed her hand and smiled.
"You know, I bet you're a wonderful cook, aren't you? I could make us dinner, but it would be miserable. All I know how to do is boil potatoes. How about you give it a try? What do you say?
There are pots and pans in that sack over there, and you'll find food in the one next to it."
Thrace nodded silently and, with one last glance upward, shuffled over to the packs.
"What kind of meal would you like?"
"Something edible would be a pleasant surprise," Royce said, adding more wood. Hadrian threw a stick at him. The thief caught it and placed it on the fire.
She dug into the packs, going so far as to stick her head inside, and emerged moments later with an armload of items. She borrowed Hadrian's knife and began cutting vegetables on the bottom of a turned-up pan. It grew dark quickly, the fire becoming the only source of light in the clearing. The flickering yellow radiance illuminated the canopy of leaves around them, creating the feel of a woodland cave. Hadrian picked out a grassy area upwind from the smoke and laid out sheets of canvas coated in pitch. It blocked the wetness that would otherwise soak in. The treated fabric was something they had come up with after years on the road, but they didn't have the time to make one for Thrace. He sighed, threw Thrace's blankets on his canvas, and went in search of pine boughs for his own bed. When dinner was ready, Royce called for Hadrian. He returned to the fire, where Thrace was dishing out a thick broth of carrots, potatoes, onions, and salted pork. Royce was sitting with a bowl on his lap and a smile on his face.
"You don't have to be that happy," Hadrian told him.
"Look, Hadrian, food."
They ate mostly in silence. Royce made a few comments about things they should pick up when they passed through Alburn, such as another length of rope and a new spoon to replace the cracked one. Hadrian mostly watched Thrace, who refused to sit near the fire. She ate alone on a rock in the shadows near the horses. When they finished, she stole away to the river to wash the pot and wooden bowls.
"Are you all right?"
Hadrian asked, finding her along the stony bank.
Thrace was crouched on a large moss-capped rock, her gown tucked tight around her ankles, as she washed the pot and bowls by scooping up what sand she could find and scrubbing them with her fingers.
"I'm fine, thank you. I'm just not used to being out at night."
Hadrian settled down beside her and began cleaning his bowl.
"I can do that," she said. "So can I. Besides, you're the customer, so you should get your money's worth."
She smirked at him. "I'm not a fool, you know. 10 silver won't even cover the feed for the horses, will it?"
"Well, what you have to understand is Mouse and Millie are very spoiled. They only eat the best grain."
He winked. She couldn't help smiling back. Thrace finished the pot and the other bowls and they walked back to camp.
"How much farther is it?"
she asked, replacing the pot and bowls in the sack.
"I'm not sure. I've never been to Dahlgren, but we made good time today, so maybe only another 4 days.
"I hope my father's all right. Mr. Harden said he would try to convince him to wait until I returned before hunting the beast."
"I hope he did. As I said, my father is a very stubborn man, and I can't imagine anyone changing his mind."
"Well, if anyone can, I suspect Mr. Harden could," Royce remarked, prodding the coals of the fire with a long stick. "How did you meet him?"
Thrace found the bed Hadrian had laid out for her near the fire, and sat down on her blanket.
"It was right after my family's funeral. It was very beautiful. The whole village turned out. Maria and Jesse Caswell hung wreaths of wild salafan on the markers. May Drundle and Rose and Verna McDern sang the Fields of the Lilies, and Deacon Thomas said a few prayers. Lena and Russell Bothwick held a reception at their house. Lena and my mother were very close."
"I don't remember you mentioning your mother. Was she—"
"My mother died 2 years ago.
"I'm sorry. Sickness?"
Thrace shook her head.
No one spoke for a while. Then Hadrian said,
"You were telling us about how you met Mr. Harden."
"Oh, yeah. Well,
I don't know how many funerals you've been to, but it starts to feel smothering. All the weeping and old stories. I snuck out. I was just wandering, really. I ended up at the village well, and there was a stranger. We don't get many of those, but that wasn't all. He had on this robe that shimmered and kind of seemed to change colours from time to time, but the big thing was he had no hands. The poor man was trying to get himself a drink of water, struggling with the bucket and rope. I asked his name, and then, oh, I don't know. I did something stupid, like starting to cry, and he asked me what was wrong. The thing was, at that moment I wasn't crying because my brother and his wife just died. I was crying because I was terrified my father would be next. I don't know why I told him. Maybe because he was a stranger. It was easy to talk to him. It all just spilled out. I felt stupid afterwards, but he was very patient. That's when he told me about the weapon and the tower, and about you two. How did he know where we were? Thrace shrugged. Don't you live there? No. We were visiting an old friend. Did he talk oddly? Did he use thee and thou a lot? No, but he spoke a bit more educated than most. He said his name was Mr. Ezra Harden. Is he a friend of yours? We only met him briefly, Hadrian explained. Like you, we helped him with a little problem he was having. The question is, why is he keeping tabs on us? Royce asked. And how? Since I don't recall dropping our names, and he couldn't have known we would be going to Colnora. All he told me is that you were needed to open the tower, and if I left right away, I could find you there. Then he arranged for me to ride with the peddler. He's been very helpful. Rather amazing, isn't it, for a man who can't even get himself a cup of water? Royce muttered. Chapter 3 The Ambassador. Arista stood at the tower window, looking down at the world below. She could see the roofs of shops and houses. They appeared as squares and triangles of grey, brown and red, pierced by chimneys left dormant on the warm spring day. The rain had washed through, leaving the world below fresh and vibrant. She watched the people walking along the streets, gathering in squares, moving in and out of doorways. Occasionally, a shout reached her ears, soft and faint. Most of the noise came from directly below in the courtyard, where a train of 7 coaches had just arrived and servants were loading trunks.
"No, no, no, not the red dress!" Bernice shouted at Melissa. "Novron, protect us! Look at that neckline! Her Highness has a reputation to protect. Put that in storage, or better yet, burn it. Why, you might as well salt her, put a garnish behind her ear, and hand her over to a pack of starving wolves. No, not the dark one either. It's nearly black. It's spring, for Maribor's sake. Where's your head? The sky blue gown, yes, that one can stay. Honestly, it's a good thing I'm here."
Bernice was an old, plump woman with a doe-like face that sagged at the cheeks and doubled at the chin. The colour of her hair was unknown, as she always wrapped it in a barbette veil that looped her head from crown to neck. To this she always added a tall cloth fillet that made it seem like the top of her head was flat. She stood in the centre of Arista's bedroom, flailing her arms and shouting amid the chaotic maelstrom that she had created. Piles of clothes lay everywhere, except in Arista's wardrobes. Those stood empty, waiting with doors wide as Bernice sorted each gown, boxing the winter dresses for storage. In addition to Melissa, Bernice had drafted 2 other girls from downstairs to assist in the packing. Bernice had filled one chest, but still her bedroom remained carpeted in gowns, and Arista already had a headache from all the shouting. Bernice had been one of her mother's handmaids. Queen Anne had kept several. Drundeline, a beautiful woman, had been her secretary and close friend. Harriet ran the residence, organizing the cleaning staff, seamstresses, and laundry. Nora, whose lazy eye always made it impossible to tell who she was actually looking at, handled the children. Arista remembered how she would tell her fairy tales at bedtime about greedy dwarves who kidnapped spoiled princesses, but a dashing prince always saved them in the end. In all, Arista could remember no fewer than 8 maids. But she could not remember Bernice. She had come to Essendon Castle nearly 2 years earlier, only a month after Arista's father, King Amrath, had been murdered. Bishop Solder explained that she had served the Queen, and was the only maid to survive the fire that killed her mother so many years earlier. He mentioned Bernice had been away for years, suffering from melancholy and sickness. But after Amrath's death, she insisted on returning to care for her beloved queen's daughter.
"Oh, Your Highness,"
Bernice said, holding 2 separate pairs of Arista's shoes.
"I do wish you would come away from that window. The weather may look pleasant, but draughts are not something to toy with. Trust me, I know all about it, intimately. Pray you never have to go through what I did. The aches, the pains, the coughing. Not that I'm complaining, of course. I'm still here, aren't I? I'm blessed with the gift of seeing you grow into a lady, and Maribor willing, I will see you as a bride. What a fine bride you'll make. I hope King Ulric picks a husband for you soon. Who knows how long I have left? And we don't want people gossiping about you any more than they already are."
"People are gossiping?" Arista turned and sat on the open windowsill. Watching her on the edge, Bernice panicked and froze in place, her mouth opening and closing with silent protests, both hands waving the shoes at her.
"Your Highness," she managed to gasp, "you'll fall."
"I'm fine."
"No, no, you're not."
Bernice shook her head frantically.
"Please, I beg of you."
She dropped the shoes, planted her feet, and reached out her hand as if standing on the edge of a precipice.
"Please."
Arista rolled her eyes, stood up, and walked away from the window. She crossed the room to her bed, which lay beneath several layers of clothes.
"No, wait!"
Bernice shouted again. She shook her hands at the wrists, as if trying to dry them.
"Melissa, clear Her Highness a place to sit."
Arista sighed and ran a hand through her hair while she waited for Melissa to gather the dresses.
"Careful now, don't wrinkle them," Bernice cautioned.
"I'm sorry, Your Highness,"
Melissa told her as she gathered an armful. She was a small redhead with dark green eyes, who had served Arista for the past 5 years. The princess got the distinct impression the maid's apology didn't refer to the mess on the bed. Arista fought to keep from laughing, and a smile emerged. It only made matters worse when she saw Melissa grinning as well.
"The good news is, the bishop delivered a list of potential suitors to His Majesty this morning,"
Bernice said, and Arista no longer had any trouble quelling laughter. The smile disappeared as well.
"I'm hoping it'll be that nice Prince Rudolph, King Armand's son."
Bernice was raising her eyebrows and grinning mischievously like some deranged pixie.
"He's very handsome, many say dashing, and Auburn is a very nice kingdom, at least so I've heard."
"I've been there, and I've met him. He's an arrogant ass."
"Oh, that tongue of yours!"
Bernice clasped her hands to the sides of her face and gazed upward, mouthing a silent prayer.
"You must learn to control yourself. If anyone else had heard you, thankfully, we're the only 2 here."
Arista glanced at Melissa and the other 2 girls busy sorting through her things. Melissa caught her look and shrugged.
"All right, So you aren't certain about Prince Rudolf, that's fine. How about King Ethelred of Warwick? You can't do better than him. The poor widower is the most powerful monarch in Avon. You would live in Equesta and be queen of the Wintertide festivals.
The man has to be in his 50s. Not to mention he's an imperialist. I'd slit my throat first.
Bernice staggered backward and threw one hand to her own neck while the other reached for the wall. Melissa snickered and tried to cover it with a pretend cough.
"I think you're done here, Melissa," Bernice said. "Take the chamber pot when you go."
"But the sorting isn't," Melissa protested. Bernice gave her a reproachful look. Melissa sighed.
"Your Highness," she said, and curtsied to Arista, then picked up the chamber pot and left.
"She didn't mean anything by it," Arista told Bernice.
"It doesn't matter. Respect must be maintained at all times. I know I'm only an old, crazy woman who doesn't matter to anyone, but I can tell you this. If I were here, if I had been well enough to raise you after your mother died, people wouldn't be calling you a witch today."
Arista's eyes widened.
"Forgive me, Your Highness, but that's the truth of it. With your mother gone and me away, I fear you were brought up poorly. Thank Maribor I came back when I did, or who knows what would become of you. But no worries, my dear. We have you on the right track now. You'll see. Everything will work out once we find you a suitable husband. All that nonsense from your past will soon be forgotten."
Her dignity, as well as the length of her gown, prevented Arista from running down the stairs. Hilfred trotted behind her, struggling to keep up with the sudden burst of speed. She had caught her bodyguard by surprise. She had surprised herself. Arista had had every intention of walking calmly up to her brother and politely asking if he had gone mad. The plan had worked fine up until she passed the chapel. Then she started moving faster and faster. "The good news is the bishop delivered a list of potential suitors to His Majesty this morning." She could still see the grin on Bernice's face and hear the perverse glee in her words, as if she were a spectator at the foot of a gallows waiting for the hangman to kick the bucket.
"I'm hoping it'll be that nice Prince Rudolf, King Armand's son."
It was hard to breathe. Her hair broke loose from the ribbon and flew behind her. As Arista rounded the turn near the ballroom, her left foot slipped out from under her, and she nearly fell. Her shoe came off and spun across the polished floor. She left it, pressing on, hobbling forward like a wagon with a broken wheel. She reached the West Gallery. It was a long, straight hallway lined with suits of armour, and here she picked up speed. Jacobs, the royal clerk, spotted her from his perch outside the reception hall and jumped to his feet.
"Your Highness!" he exclaimed with a bow.
"Is he in there?" she barked.
The little clerk with the round face and red nose nodded.
"But His Majesty is in a state meeting. He's requested that he not be disturbed."
"The man is already disturbed. I'm just here to beat some sense into his feeble little brain."
The clerk cringed. He looked like a squirrel in a rainstorm. If he had had a tail, it would have been over his head. Behind her, she heard Hilfred's familiar footsteps approach. She turned toward the door and took a step.
"You can't go in," Jacobs told her, panicking. "They're having a state meeting," he repeated.
The soldiers who stood to either side of the door stepped forward to block her.
"Out of my way," she yelled.
"Forgive us, Your Highness, but we have orders from the king not to allow anyone entrance."
"I am his sister," she protested.
"I am sorry, Your Highness. His Majesty, he specifically mentioned you."
"He... what?"
She stood stunned for a moment, then spun on the clerk, caught wiping his nose with a handkerchief.
"Who's in there with him? Who's in this state meeting?"
"What's going on?" Julian Tempest, the Lord Chamberlain, asked as he rushed out of his office. His long black robe with gold hash marks on the sleeve trailed behind him like the train of a bride.
Julian was an ancient man who had been Lord Chamberlain of Essendon Castle since before she was born, perhaps even before her father was born. Normally, he wore a powdered wig that hung down past his shoulders like the floppy ears of an old dog. But she had caught him by surprise, and all he had on was his skullcap, a few tufts of white hair sticking out like seed silk from a milkweed pod. "I want to see my brother," Arista demanded.
"But, Your Highness, he's in a state meeting. Surely it can wait."
"Who is he meeting with?"
"I believe Bishop Saldor, Chancellor Pickering, Lord Varlin and, I'm not sure who else."
Julian glanced at Jacobs for support. "And what is this meeting about?"
"Why, actually, I think it has to do with—"
He hesitated. "Your future."
"My future? They are determining my life in there, and I can't go in?"
She was livid now.
"Is Prince Rudolph in there? Lannis Ethelred, perhaps?"
I don't know. I don't think so."
Again he glanced at the clerk, who wanted no part of this.
"Your Highness, please calm down. I suspect they can hear you." "Good!" she shouted. "They should hear me. I want them to hear me. If they think I'm going to just stand here and wait for the verdict to see what they will decide my fate to be, I... Arista!"
She turned to see the doors to the throne room open. Her brother Ulrich stood trapped behind the guards, who quickly stood aside. He was wearing the white fur mantle Julian insisted he drape over his shoulders at all state functions, and the heavy gold crown, which he pushed to the back of his head.
"What is your problem? You sound like a raving lunatic." "I'll tell you what my problem is. I'm not going to let you do this to me. You are not going to send me off to Alban or Warwick like some state commodity."
"I'm not sending you to Warwick or Alban. We've already decided you're going to Dunmore."
"Dunmore?"
The word hit her like a blow.
"You're joking. Tell me you're joking."
"I was going to tell you tonight, although I thought you'd take it better. I figured you'd like it."
"Like it? Like it? Oh, yeah, I love the idea of being used as a political pawn. What are they giving you in return? Is that what you are doing in there? Auctioning me off?"
She rose on her toes, trying to get a look over her brother's shoulders to see who he was hiding in the throne room.
"Did you have them bidding on me like a prized cow?" "Prized cow? What are you talking about?"
Ulrich glanced behind him self-consciously and closed the doors. He waved at Julian and Jacobs, shooing them away. In a softer voice he said,
"It will give you some respect. You'll have genuine authority. You won't just be the princess anymore, and you'll have something to do. Weren't you the one who said you wanted to get out of your tower and contribute to the well-being of the kingdom?" "And? And this is what you thought of?"
She was ready to scream.
"Don't do this to me, Ulrich, I beg you. I know I've been an embarrassment. I know what they say about me. You think I don't hear them whispering witch under their breath? You think I don't know what was said at the trial?"
"Arista, those people were coerced, you know that." He glanced briefly at Hilfred, who stood beside her, holding the lost shoe.
"I'm just saying I know about it. I'm sure they complained to you all the time."
She gestured toward the closed door behind him. She didn't know whom she meant by they, and hoped he did not ask.
"But I can't help what people think. If you want, I'll come to more events. I'll attend the state dinners. I'll take up needlepoint. I'll make a damn tapestry. Something cute and inoffensive. How about a stag hunt? I don't know how to make a tapestry, but I bet Bernice does. She knows all that crap."
"You're going to make a tapestry?"
"If that's what it takes. I'll be better. I will. I haven't even put the lock on my door in the new tower. I haven't done a thing since you were crowned, I swear. Please, don't sentence me to a life of servitude. I don't mind being just a princess. I don't."
He looked at her, confused.
"I mean it. I really do, Ulrich. Please, don't do this."
He sighed, looking at her sadly.
"Arista, what else can I do with you?
I don't want you living like a hermit in that tower for the rest of your life. I honestly think this is for the best. It'll be good for you. You might not see it now, but don't look at me like that. I am king, and you'll do as I tell you. I need you to do this for me. The kingdom needs you to do this. She couldn't believe what she was hearing. Arista felt tears working their way forward. She locked her jaw, squeezing her teeth together, breathing faster to stave them off. She felt feverish and a little light-headed. "And I suppose I'm to be shipped off immediately. Is that why the carriages are outside?" "Yes," he said firmly. "I was hoping you would be on your way in the morning."
"Tomorrow?"
Arista felt her legs weaken, the air empty from her lungs. "Oh, for Maribor's sake, Arista, it's not like I'm ordering you to marry some old coot."
"Oh, well,
I'm so pleased you're looking out for me," she said. "Who is it, then? One of King Rosworth's nephews? Dearest Maribor, Ulric, why, Dunbor, Rudolph would have been misery enough, but at least I could understand an alliance with Alban. But Dunmore? That's just cruel. Do you hate me that much? Am I that horrible that you must marry me to some no-account duke in a backwater kingdom? Even father wouldn't have done that to me. Why are you laughing? Stop laughing, you insensitive little hobgoblin." "I'm not marrying you off, Arista," Ulric managed to get out. She narrowed her eyes at him. "You're not? God, no. Is that what you thought? I wouldn't do that. I'm familiar with the kind of people you know. I'd find myself floating down the Gale War again."
"What then?
Julian said you were deciding my fate in there." I've officially appointed you Ambassador of Melengar." She stood silent, staring at him for a long moment. Without turning her head, she shifted her eyes and grabbed her shoe from Hilfred. Leaning on his shoulder, she slipped it back on. "But Bernice said Sawley brought a list of eligible suitors," she said tentatively, cautiously.
"Oh, yes, he did,"
Ulric said, and chuckled. "We all had a good laugh at that."
"We?"
"Morven and Fannin are here." He hooked his thumb at the door. "They're going with you. Fannin plans to enter the contest the church is organizing up in Irvanon.
You see, it was supposed to be this big surprise, but you ruined everything as usual."
"I'm sorry," she said, her voice quavering unexpectedly. She threw her arms around her brother and hugged him tight.
"Thank you."
The front wheels of the carriage bounced in a hole, followed abruptly by the rear ones. Arista nearly struck her head on the roof and lost her concentration, which was frustrating because she was certain she was on the verge of recalling the name of Dunmore's Secretary of the Treasury. It started with a Bon, a Bonnie, or a Bobo. No, it couldn't be Bobo, could it? It was something like that. All these names, all these titles, the third Baron of Brodinia, the Earl of Nith. Or was it the third Baron of Nith and the Earl of Brodinia? Arista looked at the palm of her hand, wondering if she could write them there. If caught, it would be an embarrassment not just for herself, but for Ulric and all of Melengar as well. From now on, everything she did, every mistake, every stumble, would not just hurt her, it would reflect poorly on her kingdom. She had to be perfect. The problem was, she didn't know how to be perfect. She wished her brother had given her more time to prepare. Dunmore was a new kingdom, only 70 years old, an overgrown fief reclaimed from the wilderness by ambitious nobles with only passing pedigrees. It had none of the traditions or refinement found in the rest of Avon, but it did have a plethora of mind-numbing titled officers. She was convinced King Rosworth created them the way a self-conscious man might overdecorate a modest house. He certainly had more ministers than Ulric, with titles twice as long and uniquely vague, such as the Assistant Secretary of the Second Royal Avenue Inspection Quorum. What does that even mean? And then there was the simply unfathomable, since Dunmore was landlocked, Grandmaster of the Fleet. Nevertheless, Julian had provided her with a list, and she was doing her best to memorize it, along with a tally sheet of their imports, exports, trade agreements, military treaties, and even the name of the king's dog. She laid her head back on the velvet upholstery and sighed.
"Something wrong, my dear?"
Bishop Soldor inquired from his seat directly across from her, where he sat pressing his fingers together. He stared at her with unwavering eyes that took in more than her face. She would have considered his looks rude if he had been anyone else. Soldor, or Sawley, as she always called him, had taught her the art of blowing dandelions that had gone to seed when she was 5. He had shown her how to play checkers and pretended not to notice when she climbed trees or rode her pony at a gallop. For commencement on her 16th birthday, Sawley had personally instructed her on the tenets of the faith of Nephron. He was like a grandfather. He always stared at her. She had given up wondering why.
"There's too much to learn. I can't keep it all straight.
The bouncing doesn't help either. It's just that..." She flipped through the parchments on her lap, shaking her head.
"I want to do a good job, but I don't think I will."
The old man smiled at her, his eyebrows rising in sympathy.
"You'll do fine. Besides, it's only Dunmore."
He gave her a wink.
"I think you'll find His Majesty, King Roswort, an unpleasant sort of man to deal with. Dunmore has been slow to gain the virtues that the rest of civilization has learned to enjoy. Just be patient and respectful. Remember that you'll be standing in his court, not Melengar, and there you are subject to his authority. Your best ally in any discussion is silence. Learn to develop that skill. Learn to listen instead of speaking, and you'll weather many storms. Also, avoid promising anything. Give the impression you are promising, but never actually say the words. That way, Ulric always has room to maneuver. It's very bad practice to tie the hands of your monarch."
"Would you like something to drink, my lady?" Bernice asked, sitting beside Arista on the cushioned bench, guarding a basket of travel treats. She sat straight, her knees together, hands clutching the basket, thumbs rubbing it gently. Bernice beamed at her, fanning deep lines from the corners of her eyes. Her round, pudgy cheeks were forced too high by a smile, too broad. A condescending smile, the sort displayed to a child who had scraped her knee. At times, Arista wondered if the old woman was trying to be her mother.
"What have you got in there, dear?" Soldor asked. "Anything with a bite to it?"
"I brought a pint of brandy," she said, then hastily added, "in case it got cold."
"Come to think of it, I feel a bit chilled,"
Soldor said, rubbing his hands up and down his arms, pretending to shiver. Arista raised an eyebrow.
"This carriage is like an oven," she said, while pulling on the high dress collar that ran to her chin.
Ulric had emphasized that she needed to wear properly modest attire, as if she had made a habit of strolling about the castle in bosom-bearing scarlet tavern dresses. Bernice took this edict as carte blanche to imprison Arista in antiquated costumes of heavy material. The sole exception was the dress for her meeting with the King of Dunmore. Arista wanted all the help she could get to make a good impression, and decided to wear the formal reception gown that had once belonged to her mother. It was simply the most stunning dress Arista had ever seen. When her mother had worn it, every head had turned. She had looked so impressive, so magnificent, every bit the queen.
"Old bones, my dear," Soldor told her. "Come, Bernice, why don't you and I share a little cup?"
This brought a self-conscious smile to the old lady's face. Arista pulled the velvet curtain aside and looked out the window. Her carriage was in the middle of a caravan consisting of wagons and soldiers on horseback. Morven and Fannin were somewhere out there, but all she could see was what the window framed. They were in the kingdom of Ghent, although Ghent had no king. The Nephron Church administered the region directly and had for several hundred years. There were few trees in this rocky land, and the hills remained a dull brown, as if spring were tardy, off playing in other realms and neglecting its chores here. High above the plain a hawk circled in wide loops.
"Oh, dear!"
Bernice exclaimed as the carriage bounced again. "Oh, dear!" was as close as Bernice ever came to cursing. Arista glanced over to see that the jostling was making the process of pouring the brandy a challenge. Sorely with the bottle, Bernice with the cup, their arms shifting up and down, struggling to meet in the middle like in some test of skill at a Mayfair. A game that was designed to look simple, but ultimately embarrassed the players. At last, Sorely managed to tip the bottle, and they both cheered.
"Not a drop lost," he said, pleased with himself. "Here's to our new ambassador. May she do us proud."
He raised the cup, took a large mouthful, and sat back with a sigh.
"Have you been to Ervanon before, my dear?"
Arista shook her head.
"I think you'll find it spiritually uplifting. Honestly, I'm surprised your father never brought you here. It is a pilgrimage every member of the Church of Nephron needs to make once in their lifetime."
Arista nodded, failing to mention her late father had not been terribly devout. He had been required to play his part in the religious services of the kingdom, but often skipped them if the fish were biting, or if the huntsman reported spotting a stag in the river valley. Of course, there had been times when even he had sought solace. She had long wondered about his death. Why had he been in the chapel the night that miserable dwarf had stabbed him? More importantly, how had her uncle Percy known he would be there and use this knowledge to plot his death? It puzzled her until she realized he hadn't been there praying to Novron or Maribor. He had been talking to her. It had been the anniversary of the fire, the date Arista's mother had died. He had probably visited the chapel every year, and it bothered Arista that her uncle knew more about her father's habits than she did. It also disturbed her that she had never thought to join him.
"You'll have the privilege of meeting with His Holiness, the Archbishop of Ghent."
She sat up, surprised. "Ulric never mentioned anything about that. I thought we were merely passing through Ervanon, on our way to Dunmore."
"It's not a formal engagement, but he is eager to see the new ambassador to Melengar."
"Will I be seeing the Patriarch as well?" she asked, concerned. Not being prepared for Dunmore was one thing, but meeting the Patriarch with no preparation would be devastating.
"No."
Soldo smiled like a man amused by a child's struggle to take her first steps.
"Until the heir of Novron is found, the Patriarch is the closest thing we have to the voice of God. He lives his life in seclusion, speaking only on rare occasions. He is a very great man, a very holy man. Besides, we can't keep you too long. You don't want to be late for your appointment with King Roswat in Glamrendor."
"I suppose I'll miss the contest, then."
"I don't see how," the bishop said after taking another sip, which left his lips glistening.
"If I push on to Dunmore, I won't be in Ervanon to see—"
"Oh, the contest won't be held in Ervanon," Soldor explained. "Those broadsides you've no doubt seen only indicated that contestants are to gather there."
"Then where will it be?"
"Ah, well now, that's something of a secret. Given the gravity of this event, it is important to keep things under control. But I can tell you this. Dunmore will be on the way. You'll stop there long enough to have your audience with the king, and then you'll be able to continue on to the contest with the rest of them."
Ulrich will most assuredly want to have his ambassador on hand for this momentous occasion.
Oh, wonderful. I would like that. Fanon Pickering is competing. But does that mean you won't be coming?
That will be up to the Archbishop to decide.
I hope you can. I'm sure Fanon would appreciate as many people as possible cheering him on.
Oh, it's not a competition.
I know all those heralds are promoting it that way, which is unfortunate, because the Patriarch did not intend it so.
Ulrich stared at him, confused.
I thought it was a tournament.
I saw an announcement declaring the church was hosting a grand event, a test of courage and skill, the winner to receive some magnificent reward.
Yes, and all of that's true, but misleading.
Skill will not be needed so much as courage, and,
well, you'll find out.
He tipped the cup and frowned, then looked hopefully at Bernice. Arista stared at the cleric a moment longer, wondering what all that meant. But it was clear Sawley wouldn't be adding anything further on the topic. She turned back to the window, peering out once more. Hilfred trotted beside the carriage on his white stallion. Unlike Bernice, her bodyguard was unobtrusive and silent. He was always there, distant, watchful, respectful of her privacy, or as much as a man who was required to follow her everywhere could be. He was always in sight of her, but never looking. The perfect shadow. It had always been that way, but since the trial, he had been different. It was a subtle change, but she sensed he had withdrawn from her. Perhaps he felt guilty for his testimony, or maybe, like so many others, he believed some of the accusations brought against her. It was possible Hilfred thought he was serving a witch. Maybe he even regretted saving her life from the fire that night. She threw the curtain shut and sighed. It was dark by the time the caravan arrived in Irvanon. Bernice had fallen asleep, her head hanging limp over the basket, which threatened to fall. Solder had nodded off as well, his head drooping lower and lower, popping up abruptly, only to droop again. Through her window, Arista felt the cool, dewy night air splash across her face as she craned her neck to look ahead. The sky was awash in stars, giving it a light, dusty appearance, and Arista could see the dark outline of the city rising on the great hill. The lower buildings were nothing more than shadows, but from within them rose a singular finger. The crown tower was unmistakable. The alabaster battlements that ringed the top appeared like a white crown floating high in the air. The ancient remnant of the Stuarts' empire was distinctive as the tallest structure ever made by man. Even at a distance, it was awe-inspiring. Surrounding the city were campfires, flickering lights scattered across the flats like a swarm of resting fireflies. As they approached, she heard voices, shouts, laughter, arguments rising up from the many camps along the roadside. They were the contestants, and there must be hundreds of them. Arista saw only glimpses as the carriage rolled past. Faces were illuminated by the glow of firelight. Silhouetted figures carried plates. Men and boys sat on the ground laughing, tipping cups to their mouths. Tents filled the spaces in between, and lines of tethered horses and wagons lay in the shadows. The wheels and hooves of their carriage began a loud click-clack as they rolled onto cobblestone. They entered through a gate, and all she could see were torches illuminating the occasional wall, or a light in a nearby window. Arista was disappointed. She had learned about the city's history at Sheridan University and looked forward to seeing the ancient seat that had once ruled the world. In the power vacuum left after the fall of the ancient Novronian Empire, civil wars broke out and the people divided along their old Apellinese ethnic lines, forming the four nations of Apellidorn, Trent, Avron, Calais, and Delgos. Within each of these, various warlords struggled for supremacy, battling their neighbours for land and power. After more than 300 years of warfare, only one ruler ever managed to make a serious attempt at unifying the four nations into one empire again. Glenmorgan of Ghent ended the era of civil wars and, through brilliant and brutal conquests, unified Trent, Avon, Calais, and Delgos under one banner once more. The Church of Nephron threw its support behind him, but reminded the people that Glenmorgan was not the heir of Novron by naming him the Defender of the Faith and Steward to the Heir. They solidified the union by establishing the church's base in Irvenon and built their great cathedral alongside Glenmorgan Castle. The steward's reign did not last. According to Arista's professor, Glenmorgan's son was ill-suited to the task he inherited, and the steward's empire ended only 70 years after it began, collapsing with the betrayal of Glenmorgan III by his nobles. It wasn't long before Calais and Trent broke away, and Delgos declared itself a republic. Irvenon was mostly ruined in the warfare that followed, but in the aftermath, the Patriarch moved into the last remaining piece of Glenmorgan's great palace, the Crown Tower. From then on, the tower and the city became synonymous with the church, and recognized as the holiest place in the world behind the ancient, but lost, Navronian capital of Persepolis itself. The carriage stopped with a jerk that rocked the inhabitants, waking Salder and causing the old maid to gasp when her basket spilled to the floor.
"We've arrived," Salder said with a groggy voice as he wiped his eyes, yawned, and stretched.
The coachman locked the brake, climbed down, and opened the door. A rush of cool, damp air flooded inside and chilled Arista. She stepped out, stiff and weak, her head hazy. It felt strange to be standing still. They were at the very base of the massive Crown Tower. She looked up, and doing so made her dizzy. Even at that dark hour, the top stood out brightly against the night sky. The tower rested on a domed crest known as Glenmorgan's Rise, which was the highest point for miles. Even though she didn't climb a step, it appeared as if she stood at the top of the world as she looked beyond the ancient wall and down to the sprawling valley below. She yawned and shivered, and instantly Bernice was there, throwing a cloak over her shoulders and buttoning it. Sawley took longer getting out of the carriage. He slowly extended each thin leg, stretching them out and testing his weight.
"Your Grace,"
a boy appeared.
"I hope you had a pleasant journey. The Archbishop asked me to tell you he's waiting in his private chambers for the Princess."
Arista was stunned.
"Now?"
She turned to the Bishop.
"You don't expect me to meet him with a day's coating of road dust and sweat on me. I look a fright, smell like a pig, and I'm exhausted."
"You look lovely as always, my lady,"
Bernice cooed while stroking the Princess's hair. It was a habit that Arista particularly disliked.
"I'm sure the Archbishop, being a spiritual man, will be looking at your soul, not your physical person."
Arista gave Bernice a quizzical look, then rolled her eyes. Servants dressed in clerical frocks appeared around them, hauling luggage, breaking down the harnesses, and watering the horses.
"This way, Your Grace,"
the boy said, and led them into the tower. They entered a large rotunda with a polished marble floor and columns that divided the centre from a walkway that encircled the wall. As if from a great distance, she could hear soft singing. Dozens of voices, perhaps a choir, were rehearsing. Flickering light from unseen lamps bounced off polished surfaces. Their footsteps echoed loudly.
"Couldn't I see him in the morning?"
"No," Salder said. "This is a very important matter."
Arista furrowed her brow and pondered this. She had taken for granted that visiting the Archbishop was just a formality, but now she wasn't so sure. As part of Percy Braga's plot to usurp the kingdom of Melengar, he had placed her on trial for her father's death. Barred from attending the proceedings, she later heard rumours of testimony others had given, including her